From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. O'Neill's career in politics spans half a century. He looks back on his public life in his new memoir, Man of the House. Also today, I speak with violinist David Harrington, founder of the Kronos Quartet. This string quartet plays an eclectic blend of 20th century classical music, jazz, and rock. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc collection of arias by the late Maria Callas. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explores the Minitel, the computer that's becoming a standard feature in French homes. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Thomas Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House of Representatives for 10 years until his retirement this past January. O'Neill was elected to Congress in 1952, winning the seat that John Kennedy vacated when he ran for the Senate. Like Kennedy before him, O'Neill came from a political family. His father was a Boston City Councilman. As a liberal Democrat from perhaps the most liberal congressional district in the country, O'Neill rose quickly through the House ranks in the late 50s and early 60s. But his reputation as a loyal team player was shaken in 1967 when he became one of the first and most prominent Democrats to break with Lyndon Johnson over the Vietnam War. In his last year as a Speaker of the House, O'Neill was President Reagan's principal foe, leading the opposition to aid for the Contras and propose cuts in social welfare programs. Tip O'Neill has just written a memoir. It's titled Man of the House, The Life and Political Memoirs of Tip O'Neill, and it's published by Random House. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Terry, delighted to be with you.
When you got to the House, Sam Rayburn was the Speaker. And now, one of the things, I think this was in the House, yeah, he told you that he needed a vote from you in exchange for a favor he'd done for you, and that this was a vote you didn't want to give him. But he said, if I really need this vote, I'm going to signal you, and then you just have to vote that way in exchange for this favor.
Well, that's not exactly it, but what happened was a fellow by the name of Judge O'Brien from Albany, New York, and the O'Connells, political organization, they controlled the organization. They said they wanted to go down and see Sam Rayburn. So they went in and saw Sam, and they said, we have a tax problem. And the tax problem is that it's an Internal Revenue problem, and they've been sitting on it for 3 years. So the truth of the matter was that Sam took care of it, which is something you wouldn't do ethically today. And when he came back, they thanked him. They said, O'Brien is the congressman from our district. He'll be happy to give you any vote that you want. And the educational bill was coming up, or rather the offshore bill was coming up, and whether the money would go to the National Education Fund or would it go back to the states. And they said, he'll vote any way you want. And he acquiesced, and Sam said, I never did a quid pro quo in my life. But he said, you've given me your word, fine, I hope you'll stay with it. Well, time came for the vote, and O'Brien said, gee, this is terrible. You know, I can't give him a vote. It's against the principles. The papers at home know about it. So he went to see Mr. Rayburn. Mr. Rayburn said, you know, I didn't ask you for your vote. You promised it to me. I never did a quid pro quo in my life, this for that. But he said, I'll tell you, I expect you to keep your word. And he said, you go out into the House, onto the floor. And he said, if I need your vote, I expect you'll vote for me. If you don't, if I don't need your vote, he said, old Fishbait Miller would give you the signal and you vote the other way. Well, the interesting thing about that was a very important piece of legislation. Offshore oil, would it go to the states? Offshore oil, would it go to an national education program? We, who were advocating education, lost that bill, 209 votes to 203. O'Brien voted with us. How close it was. Yet as I looked at the first row, Sam Rayburn had 17 policies that he could have turned against the bill at any particular time.
Well, here's my question.
Yes.
When you became Speaker of the House, you saw how Rayburn had done it. Did you ever try anything like that?
Oh, no. The ethics of politics have changed.
So how has it changed since the days when you entered the Senate?
Well, old Sam, as I look at him, he didn't, other than the chairman of the House, he didn't know 20 members of the House. He was one of the most powerful figures in America, and power is when people believe you had power. And he could call the Internal Revenue, or he could call a cabinet member, say, be in my office at such and such a time, and they would be there. He'd call a committee chairman and say, I want you to put this in your budget or in the appropriation bill, or I want this tacked on as an amendment on the bill that you're writing. No such a thing happens today. Everything is out there with subcommittee chairman, and the press is wanting to, is following it on a day-by-day basis. So the ethics, the power, the style of politics has just completely changed in a period of 30 years.
When you were Speaker of the Massachusetts House, and here's a story I might fracture again, so help me out if I do. When you were Speaker of the Massachusetts House, you needed to chase down some votes, and there was one congressman you were looking for, and you couldn't find him. You finally found him in a stall of the men's room with his feet up so that you couldn't even see his feet beneath, but you knew he was in there. So you got him out. So, did you ever have to try tactics like that when you were Speaker of the House?
I didn't have that. You know, when I was Speaker of the Massachusetts House, each legislator was... He got so much patronage. He probably got 25 jobs and 3 trucks and things like that that were on the state programs and things like that. So every Monday you'd go over the patronage list, who was doing this and who was doing that, and were they following faithfully along with the governor's program. And if they didn't, you automatically cut them off, and they lost jobs. And those were days when the times were tough in America. But all of that is the politics of bygone days. That's the way it operated. Nothing like that, Speaker of the House had no patronage. The powerful position of the Speaker is the power of scheduling the legislature. I can sign a note and send a man around the world on a trip or something of that, or occasionally there's a page. But you don't talk about patronage in the Congress of the United States. That's the difference in the state politics of years ago and the politics that I saw enlarge in the Congress of our government.
You write about, in your memoir, you write about the post-Watergate breed of congressmen who came in who had more success because of television, and they had more, they'd won more from TV than they'd gotten from their party machine. The party machine just wasn't that important to them. And you felt that to them, you represented the establishment, an old fogey of politics. Did you really resent having that kind of image to the younger congressman?
No, as a matter of fact, I was fortunate. My image was fairly good with the new congressmen that were coming in. Most of them were anti-Vietnam War. I was the first of the establishment politician who led the fight against the war. And so I had that going in my favor. We had 92 new Democrats elected in 1974. So many of them. We never dreamed that Republicans who were in the Congress for 30 years, 25 years, and things like that would ever be defeated. And the young fellows got elected, and they had the D beside their name, and they came to Congress. They said, we would never have been here if the party thought we could have won. The party didn't help us. The party didn't support us. They didn't even have anybody running. We filled in. We're the ones that put the organization together. We're the ones that raised the money. I am here, and I'm not beholden to anybody. So that's what that was all about. And at that particular time, they fired 2 or 3. You voted, of course, for the chairman of the committees, and they fired, I believe, the first time around, either 2 or 3 chairmen that they didn't like. They were a tremendous factor in our caucus. We had probably 270, 280, I don't recall the number, but they were better than one-third of them. So they stayed together as a caucus, and they were a power. But I got along with them well because of the fact that I was a key figure in the impeachment trials and putting Watergate before the House and on the Vietnam. But they were tough, believe me.
Because of television, I think congressmen are more... visually attractive than they used to be in a way, you know, because people who get elected are the people with the really nice haircuts and the youthful good looks. Did you feel that there was more narcissism in Congress in the last 10 years or so?
Well, I would have to say that, no question about it. people say to me, how far do you think you would have gone if you were around on the age of television? When I've been on television for years, but we never use it. I never use television for the most part until I became Speaker of the House. What would the chances of a fellow with gray hair and bulbous nose and cabbage ears and overweight have. I don't know. I don't know what would have been my what are my chances. But today, it's the medium. How do you handle it? Look at the President of the United States. God gave him a beautiful physique, a handsome face, a cultured voice, and he remembers his line, and he is he's entranced the nation. They loved him just because of his ability. To dialogue with the American people in a friendly fashion. That's one of the attributes of politics today. You have to be able to handle the media, you have to be able to handle the mic, and you have to be able to have yourself well-groomed.
You know, you wrote a little bit about how some of the younger congressmen saw you as the establishment. And I wonder if you ever felt that smoking a cigar and being identified with a cigar and with the golf course ever, you know, reinforced that image to any people?
Sure, I was buffooned by the cartoonist of America, you know. Fat, overweight, cigar in your hand, the typical image.
I was never much of a drinker,
but they would always have a beer mug or something in front of me or something of that nature. But I was able to overcome it without difficulties because I stood for something and I had definite programs and I spoke my mind and I had a political insight and I had an ability to be able to lead and I made decisions. I represented a highly educational area. Probably more colleges in my district than any other, or more students in my district than any other district in the world. I never got along with the professors. They were never part. I was of my organization. The Backstreet people always elected me. But as Galbraith said, you know, he wanted to clean up the Charles River. He said 25 years before we ever heard of the environment. He was opposed to the war before the students were opposed to it. His intuition told him that something was wrong in the White House during the Nixon years. And I look with pride at my political insight. But I don't do it because of politics. Because I do it because I thought I was acting in the best interests of the country.
Tip O'Neill is my guest, and he's written a new memoir titled Man of the House. You really had a reputation for being a loyal politician and a team player, and you broke with the party and you broke with LBJ when you came out against the war in Vietnam. Was that a difficult thing to do?
That was an extremely difficult thing to do. I used to be briefed every Wednesday and Thursday, and Friday I'd go home to one of the 15 or 20 colleges that were in my district, and I would talk to the students advocating the policy of Lyndon Johnson, that we had every right over there. And one day I was at Boston College. My son and daughter were in the class. I'm talking to a group there, and they were giving me the question and answers, the same questions that were asked at Duke or North Carolina or at Wisconsin or at Berkeley. The pattern ran the same. We used to sit down and actually get the answers from Bunker, from Lodge, from Westmoreland, and people like that. And I was giving the routine answers. And a young fellow by the name of McCarthy, he was a senior. And he said, Mr. O'Neill, you say you've been briefed 44 times, that you've been briefed by 18 different people. You know more about this war than we do. Have you ever been briefed on the other side of the question? That night I'm at home and I said, you know, I've never been briefed on the other side of the question. Within a matter of a short period of time, I met with General Shock, who had just quit the Marines. And I said, you know, the war is bothering me. And we sat down. He said, I'm writing a book about it. He said, this war is wrong, wrong place, wrong time, not the right reasons. He said, here we are 10,000 miles away. 58th parallel, you can't shoot, you're being shot at. We don't mine the harbors. We don't knock out the bridge where they're bringing over the supplies. We don't knock out the generators of energy. He says the thing is wrong. And then I started to move around. I talked to assistant secretaries of state. I talked to CIA people. I talked to Army people and Navy people. I'm in Malta where my daughter was with the Foreign Service. I met the troops that were coming back, and they said, we don't know why we're there, but we resent the fact that it's being criticized at home. But it's awful when you're out there and you can't cross the parallel and you can't shoot until you're shot. And so I made my decision, and I came out against the war.
I guess I'm wondering, though, if you ever asked yourself, what is this going to do to my political career? Will it damage my political career to break ranks with the rest of the party?
Well, the interesting thing at that time, there were but very, very few, and those were some of the flag-burning students when I changed my position, they hurt me tremendously. 85% of the people in the back streets where I got my vote, they agreed with the policy of Johnson. I was hurt very, very badly. As I would come down the street, I would actually see people cross the street when they saw me coming. What's O'Neill doing? Joining those radicals down on the square? And it hurt me tremendously. And I say in my book, I remember my conversation with my son Tom, my daughter Sue. I said, I think my political end has come. But I took all the speaking engagements in my area, whether it was the Kiwanis or the Knights of Columbus or the Elks or a Holy Name Society or whatever it was, church groups of all denominations. I went in and explained how I made my decision. And the American Legion, they called a big meeting. 800 people showed up. I tell a story about Red Fitzgerald, a pal of mine. They were criticizing me for changing my policy. Red said, Tip's been in public life a long time. You and I are in the war. We wrote back whenever we had a problem, and Tip helped our families. During the years that we've been home, anytime you need something, you always go to Tip. We've had faith in him. We have trust in him. He knows more about this war and why he's did it than the rest of it. And it broke up the meeting. And I was very, very fortunate. I was lucky that particularly I had no opposition from either my own party or the Democratic Party. And as Johnson said, well, you're the first of the establishment, and you're highly regarded. And he said, I hope you don't go out there talking to the press. A snowball will go against me. One of my regrets is that I didn't speak up more loudly right then. It was only a matter of time then, of course, that we really started moving. You need one person to start the snowball going, and ultimately we denied authorizations and appropriations, and the war came to an end, and I think history is going to prove that we were at the wrong place at that particular time.
Tip O'Neill is my guest. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break.
Fine.
This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tip O'Neill is my guest, former Speaker of the House, and author of a new memoir, which is titled Man of the House. I want to move up in time a little bit to just a few years ago when President Reagan was shot, and he was immobilized, taken to the hospital. The vice president was inaccessible at the time. Now, the Constitution says that the next in line after the president is the vice president. Then you have the Senate pro tem, and then the Speaker of the House.
No, the Speaker of the House, and then the Senate pro tem.
So you're third in line.
Right.
Okay. So, but Al Haig took over and said, I am in charge here. What went through your mind? Because, you were rightfully the next in line there for that brief period in time.
Well, no, that isn't the way it operates. The president, of course, hadn't been declared that he was indisposed to the extent that he couldn't run the presidency. And there was no turning over the powers to the vice president. The vice president was coming up and playing immediately. I'll never understand what was in Al Haig's place at that particular time. Of course, as Secretary of Defense, he's fifth in line. But I was watching it on the television that day. And FEMA, the federal emergency, kept calling, you know, where are you? Are you everything all right? They kept like a half an hour check.
Just checking with you.
Checking on me, where I was and the whereabouts, and was this a national plot, and were they going after the leaders and things like that? And the answer was that I kept watching it on television, and I was surprised at Haig. I think that Haig went over to the White House at that particular time and just said, well, there's nobody, the vice president's out, the president's in the hospital. Within the party, I'm the next person, and I will take the telephone calls, and I will run. I probably probably the press may have misinterpreted the real depth of what his thought was. Did he think he was next in line for president? I really don't think that he thought that, really.
Were you very frightened during that period?
Well, it was just by chance that we had the television on in my office and was watching that because I was speaking. Then I was to speak. I think he was talking to a labor group, and I was the same. I forget what the group was, but I was supposed to address the same group the next day. And we were commenting that you don't have all that Secret Service. I got out, had no Secret Service. That people would might drive or hop out of the door and walk in. Look at all the aides that he has, and there's all of the people. Meese was with him. Young fellow by the name of Ahern from Boston was working in the White House. He threw himself over the president, as you may remember. And there were so many in that picture. And I was shocked that, we didn't know it, that the president has been shot. They put him in the hospital. 2 days later, so at my press conference, and they'd say, "Well, have you talked to the president? Have you been over to the president? What kind of condition is the president in?" And no, I haven't. Well, don't you think, as the leader of the opposition, that you ought to be talking with the president on different matters? And so yeah, I kept pressing the question so that I called the White House and I said, "Do you think it would be proper for me to go over to see the president?" I got a telephone call back, I think, from Mike Dwyer. And he said, "You go to see the president at 2 o'clock the next afternoon." And I get into there, and I brought a little Irish joke book because he's a great Irish storyteller. Thought it would bring a little mirth to him. I couldn't believe that the president was in the shape he was in. He was in pain, and then there was no reason in the world that I should have been there. And that was one of the kept secrets of the particular time. The president was far more seriously hurt than the American public thought he was at that time. He had a great constitution at his age and beautiful. Health was in beautiful condition, and he was able to forego that serious wounds that he had.
But is your responsibility to not let the public know about that?
Oh, I never mentioned about the seriousness until later on. I mentioned in the book, at that time. Matter of fact, my first reaction was, say some prayers for him. He was in tough shape.
I want to ask you something about the Bork hearings, which are going on now. In your book, you wrote that nowadays nobody wants to serve on the Judiciary Committee because it's too controversial, and you can't win if you take a stand on abortion or gun control or prayer in the schools. Do you think that people don't want to be associated with controversial issues today, no, more so than in the past?
Oh, no, there's no question about it. When I went to the Congress of the United States, the Judiciary Committee was a prime prize committee. Every lawyer that went to Washington, he wanted to participate. He wanted to be able to go home and say, "I have made the Judiciary Committee." It was one of the ranking committees. As time went along, we couldn't get members to get on that committee. And as you say, for what reasons? Well, the reasons of changing the Constitution, the reason of abortion, the reason of flagging the schools, the reason of balanced budget, the reason of redlining, giving the president power of redlining the budget. So many things, gun control, came before the committee.
But politicians are more afraid of controversy than they used to
be.
Well,
Aiden, why invite controversy to those that type of issue? Why get yourself on a committee like that when energy is the big problem of America, or the transportation of America? And it turned from that day to days of, how can I help the economy of my area? If I am Philadelphia in a harbor, I want to get on the Merchant Marine Committee. If I'm from Boston, I want to get on the Merchant Marine Committee. If we're looking for a new network of roads, I want to get on the Public Roads Committee. How do I help the economy of the area? That became the thought. By helping the economy of the area, I can build myself with a solid base from the area. I don't want to get into these controversial issues where there's a positive and a negative side with people, activists, on both sides. All you can do is get hurt.
I was looking at a News and World Report article from June of 1980, and it was comparing the assets and liabilities financially of Capitol Hill leaders. And your assets were listed as $1,000.
Probably.
In your savings account. And your outside income was $10,500 in honorariums and $6,408 in capital gains, pension, and interest. This was definitely the lowest lowest in income of every figure on that page.
That's probably true. The interesting thing, I was elected speaker, and the New York Times called me, and they said they want a net worth statement. I said, never made a net worth statement in my life. They said, we'll give you 3 hours to get a net worth statement, or we will send an investigatory team to make a net worth file. I said, all right, give me a couple of hours. I called back, and it was a Saturday afternoon. I said, I figured my net worth is $115,000. I have a home in Howardsport, and with a mortgage on it. I have a home in Cambridge with a mortgage on it. My assets of my automobiles, I don't have any money in the bank. I don't have any stock or anything of that nature. And the next day, they ran a front-page story on it. My son called me on the telephone. He says, Dad, you know, he said, I can't believe it. He said, I had more money than that when I was a senior in college. He said, gee, I never realized that my father was such a poor man. Well, he said, I want you to know that we educated, your mother and I educated five of you and kept the home fires burning, and I had to run back and forth before Washington.
We've all been noticing you in more ads now, the American Express ad, and you're in a new ad for Hush Puppies, along with Marvin Hagler, Lauren Hutton, and Deborah Harry.
Well, I don't know those people, but I do know Hagler, and he's a good friend of mine, and when they came to offer me the ad, I said, to be in an ad with Marvin Hagler, I would be honored to be in it. I think he's a great American. He's a champion. I always appreciate moving into the sports world and meeting champions, and it was a delight to do the ad.
Are you doing the ads as retirement income?
I think more than it helped, it served the ego more than it did the retirement. But true, I never had anything to equity to leave to my grandchildren, and I will be here. I'd like to build up a little equity for them.
During the years that you were serving in Washington, your family continued to live in Cambridge.
They lived in Cambridge for 25 years. We had a 14-room house there that Millie and I had bought very reasonably, and Millie was mother and father, and I commuted every weekend. And we were drained and we were strapped through most of that time.
Now that you're retired, are you learning to live together again? I mean, it must
be. Oh, Millie and I, Millie is saying to me, you're spending more time with your grandchildren than you ever spent with your own children, which is true. One of the sad parts of being away from your family and being in public life down in Washington. You know, I was so delighted the other day. My son Tommy, my grandson Tommy, he said to me, Grandpa, boy, am I glad you're retired. He said, we can see you more often. I want you to know, it thrilled me.
We only have about a minute left, but I have to ask you this. You know, whenever there's a State of the Union address, you see the Speaker of the House right behind the President, and it seems to me you'd have to be on your best behavior no matter what your temptation is. If you'd really like to be smirking or groaning due to what the President's saying, you can't do it because you're on camera. Is that a strain?
Well, that's interesting. You know, you're looking at the President, the back of the President, and you're looking over his shoulder at the teleprompter and you're reading along with him. And every once in a while, I'd comment to Bush, or Bush would comment to me. We would jest back and forth. You just can't sit there for the 26 minutes in a span of about 40 minutes without saying anything. But, I mean, that's not the normal thing to do. And so the normal thing is to comment along the line with never any thought of any kind of a disrespect to the President who's standing up there addressing the nation.
Do you miss politics now?
Oh, of course I miss it. You just can't walk away after 50 years of it. Sure, I miss it. I miss making the decisions. I miss the briefings. I miss my colleagues. I miss my old staff. Miss the press, too.
Well, I want to thank you for talking to us about your political career. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's a delight.
My guest has been former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, who's written a memoir titled Man of the House, and it's just been published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Canadian novelist Mordecai Richler, author of The Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet talks about his group's approach to 20th century music. This string quartet disregards boundaries between jazz, rock, and classical music. Their repertoire includes works by Charles Ives and Philip Glass, as well as Ornette Coleman and Jimi Hendrix. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a compact disc reissue of arias by soprano Maria Callas. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the French phenomenon of the Minitel, home computers that are changing the way the French talk to each other. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. Scratch Joe Biden from the list of Democratic presidential candidates. The Delaware senator withdrew from the race today because of admissions of plagiarism and false claims about his academic record. Biden said he entered the race to prove the idealism of his generation.
In my zeal to rekindle that idealism, I made some mistakes. But now, the exaggerated shadow of those mistakes has begun to obscure the essence of my candidacy and the essence of Joe Biden.
Biden said he had to choose between running for president and doing his job as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is conducting confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork. Biden said he'll have other opportunities to run for president. Former Chief Justice Warren Burger was on Capitol Hill today to testify in support of the nomination of Robert Bork. Senator Orrin Hatch wanted Burger's reaction to charges that Bork is out of touch with mainstream America.
If Judge Bork isn't in the mainstream, neither am I, and neither have I been.
And neither would a whole lot of others be.
I simply don't understand the suggestion that he's not in the mainstream of American constitutional doctrine. There's nothing on the record that would, in the last 7 years, it's almost 7 years since he's been on the court.
Burger told the Senate Judiciary Panel that he had not thought it would be necessary for him to testify since Bork is so well qualified, but he said there's been so much disinformation that he volunteered to do so. Iran's President Ali Khamenei today denied that his country has rejected a UN-proposed ceasefire in its war with Iraq. He said that although his speech to the United Nations yesterday spelled out Iran's basic position, it has not completely closed the door on negotiations in the Gulf itself. Meanwhile, Iran's cabinet met to discuss the U.S. attack on an Iranian ship in the Persian Gulf on Monday. More from the BBC's Jim Muir.
The Minister of Culture, Mr. Mohammad Khatami, who chaired the meeting, said the attack had brought tension in the Gulf to the highest possible level and had opened what he called a new phase in the defense of Iran. The meeting followed a series of warnings from Iranian leaders, including the commander of the Revolutionary Guards, that the American strike on the ship, the Iran Ajer, would be avenged. The attack and the Iranian warnings have created a climate of nervousness and uncertainty in the Gulf. But so far, no incidents have been reported in Gulf waters, where another American-flagged Kuwaiti tanker with U.S. naval escort is on the outward-bound voyage from Kuwait. But hostilities between Iraq and Iran have continued. The Iraqis said their jets had carried out more air raids on economic targets deep inside Iran, hitting two factories and a power station.
Jim Muir reporting from Dubai. British Foreign Secretary Geoffrey Howe said today that Great Britain will close Iran's arms purchasing offices in London. In a speech to the General Assembly of the United Nations, he urged the UN to impose an arms embargo against Iran. The Labor Department reports that inflation on the retail level rose more last month than at any time since January. Michael Richards has details.
Consumer price index rose 0.5% in August, spurred on mainly by big increases in energy costs. The price of gasoline was more than 3% higher, natural gas more than 2.5% higher, and fuel oil was about 2% more costly last month. On the other hand, grocery bills were lower, especially for beef, veal, pork, eggs, and produce. The cost of buying and financing new cars went down in August, although used ones increased in price a bit. And medical care continued to be one of the most inflationary aspects of the economy. So far this year, the consumer price index has risen at a 5.1% annual rate. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
And on Wall Street, the Dow closed up 17 points today. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last week, on the 10th anniversary of the death of Maria Callas, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed two video cassettes of German television performances by the late diva. Today, in the second part of his tribute to Callas, Lloyd has a review of a new compact disc reissue of 13 arias she recorded in the 1950s.
Much has been written about Maria Callas in the 10 years since she died, most of it sad and some of it true. There's no doubt she was a volatile personality. Her life makes a good story. But her greatest importance still lies in her recordings. No opera singer in history brought such an extraordinary dramatic range to records. Of course, everyone talks about what a great actress she was, but she always acted through the music. The drama was in her voice, in the different color that she gave each character, each mood, each phrase, each word. She could make even passages without words, like the runs and trills in the mad scene from Lucia, seem the expression of deep and complex psychological states. She not only understood the text, but the subtext. How many opera singers literally don't know what they're singing about? Her daring sense of rhythm gave unique conviction and urgency to her phrasing. With Callas, the words themselves became music. I'd like you to hear an extraordinary passage from a recital album that she recorded in 1955 and has just been reissued on a new CD called simply Operatic Arias. Though Callas is most famous as a tragedian, this is one of her rare comic numbers, Rosina's Una Voce Poco Fa from The Barber of Seville. In it, she sings of how obedient she can be, unless she's crossed. Then she'll turn into a viper and play 100 tricks. Listen for the teasing way Callas builds up her tongue-in-cheek declaration of docility until she punctures it with the word ma, but.
Oh.
Of course, no single aria can show us how she brought an entire role to life or the uncanny way she illuminated recitative. Fortunately, Angel Records has remained committed to Callas, and lots of complete Callas operas are now available on CD, including The Barber of Seville and her other great comic part, the resourceful heroine of Rossini's The Turk in Italy. But no other recording of hers surpasses this early recital in conveying her phenomenal technical and dramatic range. The CD, with its expanded dynamics, reveals a vocal freshness you couldn't always hear on LP. It includes the best recording ever made of Catalani's Ebbene ne andrò lontana, the aria from the movie Diva, a bone-chilling performance of Margherita's prison aria from Boito's Mephistophele, and even an aria one hardly associates with Callas, the bell song from Lakmé, in which the brilliant singing is for once not merely a display of vocal fireworks, but part of a touching characterization. Everything on this CD, including four additional selections from a later record, is conducted with delicacy and fire by Callas' great mentor, Tullio Serafine.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed the reissue Operatic Arias sung by Maria Callas. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Harrington. He's the first violinist and founder of the Kronos Quartet, which has a new album called White Man Sleeps. Kronos doesn't look or sound like your typical string quartet. They only play 20th century music, and they wear unconventional clothes on stage, from punk-style black leather to sequined Russian-style tunics. A typical Kronos performance might include some Bela Bartok and Dmitri Shostakovich, juxtaposed with their arrangements of the Jimi Hendrix rock hit Purple Haze and the Thelonious Monk classic Round Midnight. John Cage, Terry Riley, and Elliot Carter all have written for them, and hundreds of unsolicited compositions come their way each year. Part of their appeal comes from their choice of music and their willingness to break the rules concerning what a string quartet ought to be playing. David Harrington says they're willing to play the classics, but it has to be on their terms.
It's been many years since somebody's asked us to play, you know, a Mozart quartet or something like that. Well, I take that back. We got asked the other day to play Beethoven in Bonn, Germany in 1989. They wanted to know if we would play at the Beethoven Festival there. And I told them, sure, as long as they don't mind hearing the Grosse Fugue the way we're going to do it. And that might be with all kinds of exciting new adventures in that piece that will, in a way, I think, transcend the century and a half or so since that great piece was written.
One of the pieces on your new album is an Ornette Coleman composition called Lonely Woman, which he wrote for his own quartet, which is saxophone, bass, drums, and trumpet. What kind of challenge does it present for you to take a piece written for a jazz quartet and get a good transcription, a good interpretation for a string quartet?
You know, I've listened to the original version that Ornette did and filtered that through my own sensibility and then basically forgot about it. And what I've done since then and what all of us have done is we've made the music in the way that feels most natural to us. And so in a way there's no real, there's not a conscious attempt to sound like anybody else or to sound like Ornette. As a matter of fact, what we did last spring was we were working with Ornette on a new piece that he had written for us with oboe. And so it was a quintet. And we recorded Lonely Woman shortly after that. And so I think maybe the interpretation reflects a certain kind of sound we were working for maybe in the quintet.
Yeah, you know, your recording of Lonely Woman strikes me as a reinterpretation of Coleman's piece, because the mood and the sound of it seems very different to me than his recordings of it.
Oh, it's quite different.
The title track of your new album, White Man Sleeps, is written by Kevin Volans. And what can you tell us about him? There's actually no liner notes on the record, and I've heard several people mention that they really wanted to know who he was.
Well, Kevin Volans is a composer originally from South Africa, and we met him in Germany several years ago, and I became very interested in his work. And at that point, he had never written a string quartet. This first quartet of his has its beginning point in some of the music that he'd already written. And so in the suite White Man Sleeps, there are several movements that originated in some of his other pieces. Now, the first dance is a setting of some of the indigenous music from South Africa. And we worked closely with Volans on this interpretation. Actually, there are elements of the kinds of gaits and mannerisms of different animals. And so I think never before in the history of Western string quartet music has anybody ever been asked to imagine the gait of a baboon or of an elephant, let's say, when they're playing a piece of music. And so all of a sudden we're working with a frame of reference that we've never sensed before in any music that we'd played.
Do you ever feel that a string quartet is an anachronistic grouping for 20th century music?
Never. As a matter of fact, for me, it's probably the most moldable, malleable, exciting form that I can imagine. And I see no real end in sight to the different areas that we're going to be working in. And I think my goal in the near future is to move the frame of reference away from Central Europe, and I think you'll be hearing from us many more works whose essential flavor is coming from the let's say Japan and Africa.
Why do you want to move musically to those parts of the world?
I think that, well, first of all, the excitement of a lot of those ethnic musics that I was mentioning, those are kinds of music that have really never been explored in the European string quartet. And I think that here in the United States, it's the perfect culture to, in a way, bring things musically together. And that's exactly what we're going to be working with.
I think it's fair to say that you've helped bring new audiences to new music. Rock musicians and jazz musicians just assume they're playing current music, and they don't have to make a big deal about it being 20th century music, whereas in the classical music world, 20th century music is set apart, and that makes it more scary to some people.
Actually, I'm not afraid of our concerts being scary. As a matter of fact, I think any real artistic experience is going to be scary, because potentially what could happen is that your whole life could be changed, and in a way that you might not know the outcome, and it might have lasting effects, and it might reach a taproot in your own life that you just can't say what might happen. And this is what happened to me, for example, when I first heard the quartets of Bartok years ago. But I think, in my opinion, there's a natural way to play music, and there's a natural way to hear that experience, and that's what we're looking for.
David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet. We're listening to the Kronos Quartet playing Bartok's String Quartet No. 3 from the Kronos new album White Man Sleeps on Nonesuch Records. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, Joe Biden stepped out of the race today.
He did indeed, and Cokie Roberts will have a report on All Things Considered about Biden's withdrawal and where it leaves the field.
More coverage of the Bork hearings?
Mm-hmm. Former Chief Justice Berger testified on Bork's behalf. Opponents to his nomination today included John Hope Franklin, the historian, and other intellectuals.
What else do you have?
We have a special half hour of the program today devoted to issues about the homeless and involuntary institutionalization as a new standard takes effect in New York City soon.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Home computers, which are linked to central networks, are transforming social interactions in this country and around the world. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg recently spent his vacation in France, where one of these systems has made the electronic rendezvous the chic way to go.
A couple of years ago, the French took the bold step of giving every telephone subscriber a small computer terminal called a Minitel. Using your Minitel, you can dial up not only telephone directory information, but also a range of public and private services. You can play computer games, take language lessons, and read stock reports, or even make plane or restaurant reservations. But the services that have gotten the most attention are what the French call the messagerie, or computer message systems. When you dial into one of the messagerie, you can carry on conversations or correspondences with other people who are dialed into the same system. Some of the messagerie are used as mail services for normal business or for personal communication, but what most people are talking about these days are the controversial messagerie rose, or the pink services, which specialize in explicit sexual conversation. I guess we'd call them blue services. The use of these messagerie has become something of a national obsession. Everywhere you go, you see Minitel magazines and advertisements for messagerie rose with names like Telegay, Sado, and Toride. You get the impression that the entire French nation is hunched over its computer terminals, writing mash notes to one another. Of course, we have electronic mail systems like these in America, but they are mostly used within organizations where everyone has access to a computer terminal, in industry, in the universities, or, as the Iran Gate hearings revealed, in the White House. I've gotten to depend on the system I use at work. In fact, I often find myself using electronic mail where I would have used the telephone before, whether it's a question of setting up a lunch date with a colleague or keeping in touch with a friend who teaches at a university across the country. What makes the French experiment interesting is that it shows what could happen when this kind of technology is widely available to the general public. Most of the technological innovations in communication over the past century have had the effect of replacing the use of writing with the use of speech. On the one hand, radio and television took over a lot of the functions of newspapers. And in the same way, the telephone changed our habits of personal communication. In Dickens' London, for example, there were 3 or 4 daily mail deliveries, and the post office provided same-day service to most of England. A middle-class Englishman might write 10 personal letters in a day. Whereas nowadays, we do most of our reaching out and touching someone over the phone. For myself, the only friends I still write letters to live in West Africa, and I suppose I'd call them, too, if I thought I had a chance of getting through on the local phone systems. But now we've finally gotten technologies that allow us to transmit written texts efficiently. You can address an electronic message to an individual or to a group. It'll be delivered immediately. What's more, the receiver can read it at his leisure, and you don't have to mess around with answering machines or wait around while somebody puts you on hold. Or, like the French, you can communicate with electronic pen pals without having to go through the time and expense of exchanging physical documents. As you browse through the letters and announcements that people send over the French messagerie, you can see people struggling to render their thoughts in writing, often for the first time in their lives. Of course, they are often pretentious or crude, and many of them have only the vaguest idea of spelling and grammar, but they are writing personal letters, which is something that most Americans don't do anymore. So I suppose we should welcome the new age of electronic mail, even if it doesn't have quite the romance of the old. There will be no more love notes dipped in rosewater and hidden in a hollow stump, just the flicker of phosphor on the screen.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Ron Coslow, creator of Beauty and the Beast, the new CBS television series that modernizes the fable and sets it in the labyrinth of tunnels under the streets of Manhattan. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review albums by John Cougar Mellencamp and Dave Alvin. And guest film critic Michael Schrago will review Tough Guys Don't Dance. Norman Mailer directed it and adapted it from his best-selling novel. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.